Accession number 1677H, reel 3.
Mr. Happel, reel 3.
I got a telephone call while I was on repatriation leave from the War Office, a unit called Army Education AE5B. They asked me to go down to London to see them and said that they wanted somebody to tour the country giving lectures on the Far East, particularly to units that were going to go out to the Far East. So I said I was quite well happy to do that. So immediately I was sent off to Scotland, and I toured around Scotland giving lectures, and from there I went down to Kent. Now this was January, February, and whereas Scotland had been very pleasant from the weather point of view, I got stuck in the snow in Kent. but I went to all the commands except Northern Ireland lecturing. And when this finished,
What type of things were you telling them?
Well, the idea was, and it was a very good idea, that I'd go to a unit, and if they were going to the Far East, I'd tell them what to expect and what to take and that sort of thing. I mean, there was a book issued to us before we went out to India in 1942, which said that it was not necessary to take polo ponies with you because you could buy them cheaper in India. When that book had been written, I really do not know, but it was that sort of idea. In actual fact, they sometimes sent me to places where that just did not work. I mean, I went one day. I went to the intelligence school at Wentworth Woodhouse and lectured to the students there. Probably some of them might be going out to the Far East, but not the whole lot. And from there, I was sent to a military detention centre at Sowerby Bridge, where quite a number of people should have gone out to the Far East but had refused to do so, and they were therefore in detention. I was treated just as a sort of casual lecturer turning up, but I quite enjoyed it, and I think the troops did also, because at least they were sitting down and could go to sleep if they wanted to.
What type of lessons did you emphasise about living and working in the Far East?
Well, one thing I told them was that they must not expect to be met and, looked after, shall we say, by the European population, because the European population was so small. Whereas if you were posted to a town in England, you would meet people, you'd be invited to their homes and that sort of thing. In India, that was impossible because there were so few people and they couldn't possibly entertain in the way that they've got in England. And so you were very much left to your own unit devices. And I also lectured upon Gurkhas and the Indian Army generally. And I'd have a list of about half a dozen subjects, and I would ask them beforehand, you know, whoever was in charge, which they would prefer. But when this finished, I thought, as I was going to continue in the legal line, that it might benefit me if I could get a legal job. So I applied to the Judge Advocate General's Department, asking if I could have some legal work. I heard nothing, and so I went to my regimental depot. I transferred back to the Loyal Regiment, and I went to the regimental depot at Dalton in Furness. And there I was put in charge of discharging people. Men were coming back with priority discharges because of their particular trades that were needed for, you know, rebuilding things and that sort of thing. And I had to interview them and write out references for them and so on. And I did that for a few weeks, and then I was asked to go to the Judge Advocate General's Department and they offered me a posting to Germany, to the war crimes section at Bad Oeynhausen, which of course was the headquarters of the British Army of the Rhine at that time. And so I went out to Germany and was put into this this office. The Judge Advocate General in charge in Germany at that time was Lord Russell of Liverpool. But he seemed to be spending most of his time down at the major war crimes trials at Nuremberg. I was put into an office and I was given the job of investigating alleged war crimes. We had many allegations of war crimes from Germans, from British troops, so on. And we had a team of investigators. Quite a lot of them were Jewish, and could speak German. You know, they got out of Germany before the war and been to the British Army, and they knew how to get about in Germany, and they knew how to they knew the language. And then, from time to time, I was sent off to actually carry out prosecutions of war criminals. For example, there was a big concentration camp just outside Hamburg called Neuengamme, and I was sent to prosecute a man there. He was an SS sergeant, I would think his rank was about, and he was accused of ill treatment of prisoners in the camp, and of actually kicking a Russian officer to death in the camp. We had evidence from people who'd been in the camp, in particular one of the Kapos, they call them. They were the people who were put in charge of the who were prisoners themselves, who were put in charge of the prisoners. And this man had kept very, very good records. And what this chap had done, he was the responsible for when a new prisoner came in, for fingerprinting him and taking a photograph of him. And for the photograph, he got the prisoners to sit in a chair. It was an old barber's chair, actually. And he said that the prisoners didn't get up quickly enough after the photograph had been taken. So he fitted a spike into the chair on a spring. And when he pushed a foot lever that he'd put in the back of the chair, the spike sprang up into the prisoner, which was expected to get them onto their feet. Now, the spike was 6 inches long and tapered and was as sharp as a very sharp pencil. And he admitted this, but he said it didn't work very often because it stuck. And he'd copied it from one they had at, Dachau. Well, when you get a man actually admitting that he had done this, he didn't admit kicking the Russian officer to death, but nevertheless, he was convicted. And then I went to a place.
This was at Neuengamme.
This was at, yes. The trials were always held as near as possible to where the event had taken place. And the German public were encouraged to attend. The difficulty was, of course, that everything had to be translated. And that took time. Then I did one which I was not happy with. It was an RAF man who'd landed by parachute during an air raid, shot down, and there were a group of 6 people who'd beaten him up. They hadn't killed him, they'd beaten him up. We didn't have the officer, the RAF man, and these people were charged with ill-treating a prisoner of war. I was never very happy with that particular one. They were convicted because they'd done it, but it was the sort of thing that most people would do in the circumstances, probably died of an air raid. And it's a little illogical for people to understand that while the person's up in the aeroplane, if you can shoot him, that's fine, that's war. But if he lands by parachute, he's a prisoner of war and you mustn't touch him. Anyway, that was a case. Then there was one at Duisburg, near Dusseldorf. And this was a chap who'd landed by parachute. And we didn't know which Air Force he came from because they were rather vague about the colour of his uniform. But he was being led along the street by a policeman who had captured him, leading him along, going to take him to a police station. And he was met by a Luftwaffe man who said, oh, he should be taken to the Luftwaffe, not to the police. Now, this was all observed from the Kreisleitung, the town hall, by the head of the trade union, the Deutsches Arbeitsfront. And he had a Kreisleiter, I think he was, with him. And he looked out and he said, what's going on down there? So he shouted to them, bring that man up here. So they brought him up. And to their horror, and we had the policeman as a witness, he pulled a pistol out and shot him dead. They wrapped the body up in brown paper and threw it into the Rhine that night. Well, that was a good case. I mean, the man was a prisoner of war. He was being treated properly by the police and by the Luftwaffe. And here the leader of the trade union took it into his head to shoot him. So he was hanged, as well as the chap from the Neuen Gamma concentration camp. And then I had another one. He was a man who was the foreman of a quarry. And this quarry was being used as what they called a Straflager, a punishment prisoner of war camp for prisoners who hadn't behaved properly. And three of them were left behind because they hadn't finished their task of filling so many trucks with stone. And one of them, a man called, I remember his name now, it was a beer, and he was in the Princess Louise of Kensington's own regiment. And this foreman started shouting at him. And he called over a young guard in the army. He was only probably about 16, I believe. And said, hit this man. So the boy went to hit him with the butt of his rifle. And he said, oh, use your rifle properly, shoot him. And the boy shot him dead. And the two other men standing watching, who came and gave evidence, said that he had his battle dress blouse folded over his arm at the time that he was actually hit. He wasn't doing anything that he shouldn't be doing. So we couldn't get the boy. He'd been sent to the Russian front after that. But we, of course, we did get the foreman, and he was found guilty. And I had a number of other cases, but they were rather minor ones. And, of course, there was the investigation thing going on all the time, which was most unpleasant because in some cases there was really no evidence against the accused at all. They'd just been accused by their neighbours. I remember one case in which a man was arrested and he was put into prison that we had while investigations went on. He was accused of throwing an airman who'd landed on the roof of his house into the street and thus killing him. Now, when the investigating officer went round, he found that the airman certainly had landed on the roof, but his parachute hadn't opened. He'd gone clean through the roof. The hole was still there with a bit of tarpaulin over it. He'd gone through the ceiling of the bedroom and hit the bedroom floor and cracked the joist underneath the floor. So he was obviously very dead before he was thrown into the street. So, of course, we had to release that man. But it was his neighbours who'd reported him. And then there was another case, which was rather upsetting. It was very hot weather, and one of the officers who shared a room with me had gone on leave, and there was a great pile of files on his desk, and a terrible smell developed. And we finally searched through the files, and we found one at the bottom which was causing the smell. It was a Belgian family, mother and father and two children, I think, who'd been killed by the 12th SS Panzer Grenadier Division, and the investigators had found their grave, dug it up, taken photographs of the very decomposed bodies, and taken papers and things from the bodies, and it was these papers and things that were causing the smell. And unfortunately, it got into the photographs, and so when you looked at the photograph, you saw this decomposed body, and you could smell it as well. It was most unpleasant. We put the file in a shed at the bottom of the garden. Well, I stayed there until October, I think it was, in 1946, and then I was due for release. Went back to England, and my final leave terminated, I think, in January of 1947.
Coming back to your period in Germany, the Germans often complain nowadays about these kind of war crimes investigations because they consider it to be the justice of the victorious. What did you feel about that yourself?
Well, I felt that in one or two cases, as I said, this case of the six people who had beaten up an airman who'd landed by parachute, that wasn't really very reasonable to prosecute them, and the punishment they would get would not be very much. With the other cases, they were clearly cases which ought to be prosecuted, and the people ought to be punished properly. And of course, when one looked at a great many of our files, which are cases very often, of course, we couldn't find the perpetrators, the amount of crimes that had been committed was very great indeed. There were three words. I don't speak German. There were three words that we came across all the time: Sonderbehandelt, specially dealt with, which meant that the person had been killed; Gnickschuss, which was the method of killing, shot in the back of the neck; and Führerbefehl, which was the defence. They always tried to put up that it was they were acting on orders from above. And of course, in English law, orders, unlawful orders, are no protection against a person who actually carries out a crime. And there was it was made a rule in the trials that this Führerbefehl defence was not to be used. No, I think it was very fairly done, particularly in the British and I think the American section. I'm not too sure about the Russian section, because we used to, if we came across war crimes that were being committed in the Russian part of Germany, we sent the details to the Russians, and I was there for some months, and we'd only just started getting replies back from the Russians, and as they were in Russian and we hadn't got a translator, we couldn't do very much about them. But we had good liaison with the Americans about war crimes. Now, I think that it was reasonable in the circumstances, and the courts were carried out in a perfectly proper manner. Any accused person was allotted a British officer to assist them, and of course they also had German barristers to defend them. The officer was there to, if they asked for a particular witness to be got hold of, to make arrangements for that sort of thing. The only difficulty, of course, was that the German barristers were not very used to defending people before a court like ours, and didn't seem to have very much concept of the art of cross-examination. They made speeches, but not to any great with any great success. The courts were formed of British officers But there were permanent chairmen who were legally qualified people. And with serious cases, very serious cases, there was somebody from the Judge Advocate General's department. And on occasion, there were senior British barristers brought out to sit on the tribunal and act as advisors on legal matters. So I think in the circumstances, and they were very special circumstances, that the whole thing was perfectly fair and well organised.
Did you get any feedback from the German population as to what they felt about?
Yes, particularly in the case of the quarry foreman. I remember the reaction of the German audience was quite strong. And similarly with the case at Duisburg, the man from the trade union. There were sort of gasps of horror almost went round the court. But then, of course, the people who attended, I suppose, were willing to be impressed because they were the sort of people who had not really agreed with what had been going on.
Did you ever get any criticism from Germans about Allied procedures?
None whatever. I did have a long conversation with one German barrister who admitted that he'd been a prisoner of the Russians and he'd managed to escape and get into the British zone. Now, strictly speaking, I suppose I should have put him under arrest and sent him back to the Russians, but I didn't. And he said about the difficulties that the German barristers had in regard to the procedure, because they were not used to our accusative system. There are two systems. There's the accusative system, which we use, and then there's the other system, which the French and the Germans use, where a thing is very much investigated by a judge before it actually comes to trial, and you don't get the amount of cross examination that we do in our system.
Had you been surprised yourself at what was turned up when you were doing this job?
Yes, I was surprised because although one knew about Belsen and the various discoveries and things, we'd a lot of details about Auschwitz. I mean, I can remember photographs of a room stacked up with human hair. To be vast quantities of the stuff and great piles of false teeth and all that sort of thing. It was only when you saw the size of the whole thing that and I remember one case in particular papers that I saw about one of the concentration camps. I can't remember which it was, where they were shooting people. And they were sending the returns back to headquarters, and they got a message saying, this is no good. We're sending details of a gas chamber. You must have a gas chamber because you're not killing enough people by shooting them. And, of course, we did have the prosecution of the people that produced the gas that was used in the gas chambers, some stuff called Zyklon B, which was made in Hamburg, I think. It had been developed to kill rats in ships. And it was used in the gas chambers at Auschwitz and places like that.